Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law and Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, May 22, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the new book, Democracy in Decline, by author James Allen. We welcome to our call today a special moderator, Mr. Jim Haynes. He's a longtime Federalist Society member and an attorney and an alternate judge in the Employees' Compensation Appeals Board at the U.S. Department of Labor. We're very pleased to have both of them with us today, and we look forward to a great discussion of the new book. The book, by the way, is available at the link that was provided to you in the notice of today's call and is also available on our website, the Federalist Society's website. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear some back and forth between our two guests, and some questions will be posed, and answers will be given by the author. But ultimately, as always, we'll be turning to you, the audience, for your questions. So please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Mr. Jim Haynes, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much, Dean. It's a pleasure to have Professor Allen calling in from Brisbane, Australia, where it's very early in the morning right now, to join us and talk about the book that he's recently completed, Democracy in Decline, Steps in the Wrong Direction. It sounds like a kind of contrarian title, and I wanted to take the opportunity to let the professor explain why he doesn't seem to agree with everyone who thinks that democracy is doing just fine in the world today. So, Professor, would you explain how it is that you came to the view that we should be looking with concern at the institution of democracy?
Thank you, Jim. And first, let me just thank the Federalist Society and you and Dean for taking the time to allow me to speak to everyone today. It's a great organization. We're well aware of it here in Australia. And I actually have a Canadian accent, if people are wondering. I've moved around a lot. So good question. Well, I make it clear in the book that I'm focusing on basically five of the oldest democracies in the world, the English-speaking countries of the U.S., the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. I think you're right. If you looked at sort of all of the countries since the Berlin Wall came down, you'd see that the number of democracies has gone up a lot. But in the oldest democracies, the ones, and really these five countries I'm talking about, I mean, Australia is a relatively new country. Its constitution is barely 100-plus years old. And it's one of the oldest written constitutions in the world if you look at continuous democracies. So they're the kind of countries that Mark Stein calls the Anglosphere core democracies. Those are the ones I'm focusing on. And my argument in the book is that the scope, whatever the starting point is, and all five countries have different starting points, you know, the Americans with the Madisonian checks and balances worldview, the New Zealanders with no checks and balances democracy, whatever the starting point, in the last 30, 40 years, there have been inroads into democracy. We see it with hyperactive judges who are using new approaches to interpreting legal text to give themselves more decision-making power at the point of application. We see it with all aspects of international law making inroads. We see it with supranational bodies like the UNHRC. It's happening everywhere, I think, and it's a worry. Now, of course, if you're living in the U.S., you're living in Canada, it's a great place to live by world standards, and there's lots of input, democratically speaking, compared to most places. It's just that the trend is bad, and it's been going down in all five of these countries. I suspect in all long-established democracies, with the possible exception of Switzerland. So that's what the point of the book is.
Now, you begin with spending kind of a surprising amount of time even trying to define what you mean by a democracy and how the term democracy is popularly understood, as if this, even the use of language and the understanding of language has gotten to be a problem. How did you realize that this was going to be where your book started?
Well, part of my daytime job is to teach in one of the oldest really good Australian law schools, but I've had sabbaticals at Cornell and your wonderful University of San Diego Law School, and so I spend a lot of my time teaching constitutional law, and in Australia it's compulsory to take a jurisprudence course. So the students read Hart, they read Dworkin. I mean, all your listeners will be familiar with Dworkin, people like that. And one of the things you notice is in the last few decades, what people mean by democracy is a very open for debate topic. So I think I thought I needed to make clear what I'm talking about. People end up arguing about the meaning of the word. I think if you go back 40 years, most people by democracy see it as a procedural device. It's a way to make decisions. It's a how do you decide? You count everyone equally. You count heads and they elect representatives who make decisions. And on that understanding of democracy, sometimes a democracy can do nasty things or things we don't like or illiberal things or things that aren't rights respecting. In the last few decades, democracy has become for many people, has become a much more morally laden or morally impregnated term. It basically means all good things you've ever wanted. So it's not a democracy or it's not democratic if it's not rights respecting. It doesn't make the right call on same-sex marriage. Or it's not a democracy if it doesn't make the right call on some other moral issue that's really dear to your heart, euthanasia, abortion, take your pick. And once you stuff this concept of democracy with so much moral substantive content, it becomes very difficult to argue that democracy is in decline, because you end up arguing about whether they made the right call on same-sex marriage. And I think that's a mistake. I think you need room for other concepts other than democracy being a stand-in for everything. It makes it very difficult. So I'm only caring about how much room there is for the average person to have input into decision-making. And, you know, one of the examples I use in my book is look at how they decided same-sex marriage in California versus New York. It's just so much preferable in New York, whatever your views on the substantive outcome. In New York, they take it to the legislature, and they decide. In California, the legislature says no to same-sex marriage. They go through the Californian courts and get overruled. They have the most expensive and the biggest turnout referendum, and they override the judges. They go back to the Californian courts. They lose there, the proponents, and then they go to the federal courts. It ends up in the Supreme Court. You know, what an awful way to make a decision. It's procedurally terrible. If you have any inclination at all towards, you know, letting people have a say other than 7 or 9 judges, it's just a terrible way to make a decision. Now, you could say, I'd say that's not democratic. Now, you could say it's democratic if all that matters to you is getting your call on same-sex marriage right. And so I think part of the problem is that the term democracy now has become laden. It's so stuffed full of moral content that so you're right. I made that argument early in the book. Throw the word out if you don't like it.
And then you also mentioned that you run into people who claim to be agnostic about the value of democracy in the term that you use it as being simply a procedural way of counting people, including people, giving people an input. Maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's not. Do you find that?
Yeah, well, I think I told you on the phone when we first chatted a couple of days ago to set up this talk that professionally I go to a lot of sort of Bill of Rights type conferences or human rights type conferences, and I'm something of a skeptic on some of the human rights type stuff. I'm a big skeptic, actually, but I'd have to do it professionally. And if you get a few drinks into a lot of these people, they will tell you that really they don't have a lot of confidence in their fellow citizens to make these decisions. And I think that's now there's nothing. It's a respectable point of view, the old sort of aristocratic point of view, where you say, look, some of these things are best taken out of the hands of the masses. It's not a view I share. I think it's wrong. But it's respectable if you come out of the closet and say that. Most of the what I'm going to term the human rights crowd, there's a sort of a weird combination. They don't really have much confidence, I generalize, in their fellow citizens, and they're also so morally self-satisfied. I mean, I think it's like going to a Salvation Army revivalist meeting. The air is full of self-satisfaction, moral self-satisfaction. The only difference is the Salvation Army actually does good work for the world, and I don't think these people actually can cash out their, a lot of their arguments don't cash out very well in terms of making the world a better place. But, I mean, if you had to go to some of these conferences where you're discussing some aspect of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights or the UNHCR, there's just a sense that they're doing God's work. And it's actually factually wrong, I think. But so that's what I meant by what I said to you on the phone. That's another problem, of course.
So then you've almost described a two sides of the same coin argument, one side of the coin being that democracy has acquired a sort of collection of moral qualifications, that it's only democracy if certain outcomes are reached, or it's only democracy if they use certain language and niceties, whatever those qualifications might be, and in different groups you have different qualifications. The other side of the coin is that regardless really of a kind of policy orientation, you have people now who simply, perhaps quietly, perhaps more outspokenly, depending on how late you've had them out drinking, Professor, will say that they don't believe that the people, their neighbors, whose votes are going to count the same, really deserve to have their votes count the same. So those arguments do fit together.
They pretty much accurately described the proponents of same-sex marriage in California, who just kept going back to try to override the clear view of the majority of Californians. One of the things about my understanding of democracy, the sort of letting the numbers count understanding, is that you can't expect to be on the winning side of every issue. And no matter how deeply you feel about some issue, the right recourse is to work for the party you want to one day get back into power and change things. The right recourse is not to run off to the courts or to some international body or committee that monitors a treaty and scream tyranny of the majority. One of the weird things about that phrase, tyranny of the majority, is that most people never cash it out. It just simply cannot mean you've actually lost a vote. If you trigger tyranny of the majority simply by being on the losing side of a vote, then you really can't vote about anything. So to make that phrase tyranny of the majority work, you really have to imagine a situation where an identifiable group is on the losing side of virtually everything. So they lose on who can marry, they lose on abortion, they lose on tax rates, they lose on who can vote, all sorts of things. And that starts to look like tyranny of the majority if there's this identifiable group that loses on just about everything. But if you lose on same-sex marriage or you lose on abortion with your fellow citizens, that's not tyranny of the majority. That's losing a vote, which is at the heart of democracy. And I can't tell you how many times people trot out this idea of tyranny of the majority because they've been on the losing side of a single vote. You're thinking, well, basically, you can't vote on anything on your understanding. Of course, they never say tyranny of the majority when they're on the winning side of a vote. When they win the Affordable Care Act vote, they never say tyranny of the majority. So, again, that's another way of looking at the same problem, that sometimes you just, if you're an adherent of the concept of democracy, you have to concede that in a country of 330 million or 60 million in the UK, or what is it, 80 with there, you're just going to lose sometimes. And that can't be the trigger for complaining about how decisions are made.
Now,
one of the
aspects of your book that causes it to stand out a little from the pack of kind of political science and jurisprudence books is, first of all, that it's seemed clearly aimed at a general audience, not at an audience of lawyers, and secondly, that you make the argument that there are meaningful similarities among a very diverse kind of bag of countries, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. What sorts of similarities did you find?
Well, firstly, the five countries share a lot. We share not just a history. I mean, it's true the Americans had your War of Independence, but really the similarities between the five countries, leave aside that they're five of the oldest democracies in the world. You look hard for other countries that have as old a democratic credential. Obviously Switzerland, maybe Iceland. So here's some similarities, as I point out at the beginning of the book. It's not the core of the book, but Australia, for instance, has the most successful copy of the American Constitution. We have an American Constitution. So when the founders of Australia looked at what kind of a constitution they wanted, a written constitution, basically here in Australia we just copied the U.S. Constitution, but we copied the first Madisonian Constitution, not his. So they looked at it and they said, we want the American style of bicameralism. That's pretty unusual, with a very strong elected upper house. You don't see that in Britain. You don't see that in Canada. You don't see that in very many places, to be honest, a very strong elected upper house. Basically chosen in the same way as the states, as you're in the U.S., except here there's 12 senators for each of the six states. We have your version of federalism. And they spent a long time debating about whether to have a Bill of Rights in the 1890s, and they opted not to have a Bill of Rights, which is quite unusual for Americans, I know, because Australia is still, it's pretty much the only democracy in the world without a national Bill of Rights. And they were worried that judges would become too powerful. Now, I know this is going to sound odd to American listeners, but I think they got the call right in Australia. Here's the thing. If you have Justice Scalia, whom I really like, if you have his view of the world and how interpretation ought to take place, and that you know, a Bill of Rights is locking in a new floor, and above that floor you still leave things to Congress so that you'll debate same-sex marriage in the legislature and abortion, and all the Bill of Rights is doing is locking in a new floor, and you interpret by going back and looking at the original understanding, that's a pretty attractive view. But the Australian founders were worried that that's not what would happen, and they got that spot on, in my view. When you look at how judges are interpreting across all five countries today that I'm talking about, there's very few originalists out there. I'd like there to be more. I'm sure most of the members of your organization. But the fact is, in Canada, there's not a single originalist on the Canadian Supreme Court. They're all what in Canada we call living tree judges, and you guys call living constitution. The understanding that the words stay the same, but the meaning changes through time because these top ex-lawyers have their fingers on the pulse of changing social values, or they have their fingers on the, you know, evolving moral standards. And it's, you know, just garbage. And once you admit that that's the way judges are going to interpret, there's very little that's attractive about a Bill of Rights at that point, in my view, because what you're really doing is saying, we have no idea where this is going to end, and the people who tell us will be a committee of unelected ex-lawyers. And so Australia does not have a Bill of Rights. I think they made the right call. You know, it always scores in the top two or three in the UN's nice places to live. Canada shares a lot with the U.S. Historically. Now, all the other countries outside the U.S. are all Westminster systems, parliamentary systems, but the heritage, the common law, the treatment of judges, all the same. You have to go to France and Germany to see a civil law system very different. So I thought they had a lot in common, and I was going to focus on them. I also, those are the countries I know about, and I've worked in all five countries. And I thought, once you get into talking about, say, France, you're in a bit of a different solar system. They have an even older Bill of Rights than the U.S. The U.S. is the second oldest in the world. The French Declaration of Rights of Man is the oldest. But until about 5 years ago, you couldn't go to court and invoke it. It was not justiciable. It was a sort of aspirational document. So it's so different. And the civil law treatment, the judges tend to be less powerful in civil law systems. I didn't want to get into that, not least because I probably would start saying things that would be wrong. So I did focus on these five countries. They do share a lot. You know, we have lots of lawyers that we put through our best law schools in Australia end up working in New York. Lots of Americans end up working in law in London. So the countries do share a lot. And so I thought my argument works better if instead of pointing to one country, I say, look at these five established democracies. We got the same problems in all of them, and it's not good. The trend's not good.
Now, in terms of looking at sources of alternatives to letting the numbers count democracy. Your book also mentions that international law. It spends some time actually on the question of international law, which you divide down into dressed and undressed international law, which I guess we can get into in a second. But that people who are simply walking around on the streets living ordinary and untroubled lives are more influenced than they imagine by international law and international agencies.
Well, I think they are. I mean, the U.S. is as good as it gets in trying not to pay too much attention to international law. So basically, I just take the reader on a sort of quick romp through the, because my goal is to write for the educated layperson, not just lawyers. But even there, even with lawyers, I'm pretty skeptical that if you walked into a room of the smart lawyers in the Federalist Society, they could name more. I'd be surprised if they could name one or two judges on the International Court of Justice, or one or two judges on the International Court of Justice, which has 15 members. In fact, I'd be surprised if many people could. So international law is treaties. Americans take treaties seriously. They have to be, they have to get through your Senate, as you know, two-thirds. In all the other countries that I'm talking about, you can enter into a treaty through, the executive can do it with no vetting at all by the legislature, which makes it a lot easier to get treaties through. And Clinton can go off and sign something in Copenhagen or Kyoto, and it doesn't mean anything if he can't get it through the Senate. That's not true in the Westminster world. Now, the trade-off for that used to be that in Canada or Britain, you'd sign this treaty, but it wasn't part of your domestic law. It was sort of this thing that sat there and, you know, was aspirational. And what's happened outside the U.S. is in the last 40 years, judges have started interpreting regulations, and later after that, statutes, and in some countries like Canada, the Constitution, in the light of these international treaties. If you were a public choice person, you'd say that the executive and the judiciary are ganging up on the legislature, which you see in the U.S., by the way, in different contexts. So that's a problem. Even in the U.S., though, with treaties, you've got some of your Supreme Court judges that in a few cases are referring to unratified treaties. Because you can't get them through in the U.S., some of your Supreme Court judges, when they're interpreting your Constitution, they're citing and looking at international treaties. Well, what a bizarre understanding of what you're supposed to be doing when you interpret a legal text, when you can say that the meaning of this text is somehow influenced by a treaty that didn't even, that got ratified would be weird enough, but didn't get ratified. And then the other problematic part of international law, what I call undressed international law, it's not my distinction, what you might think of as the common law of international law, the part that doesn't flow out of treaties. There isn't a democratic bone in its body. It's made by so-called publicists. These are committed experts. And you have to sort of pass a purity soundness test to count as a publicist if you're a law professor. And then these judges on the ICJ. And, they look at the practice of states, and then that's now inflated to mean the sort of practice of states. You can intuit from things they say as opposed to things they do. And international law used to really be restricted to the law of nations, but now, of course, it's how the nations treat their own citizens. You get this weird sort of thing where there'll be some committee that monitors a rights-related treaty, and that committee will have members on it from Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Cuba, you think I'm making this up, Libya, and they'll be monitoring what kind of laws we make in Canada or the UK. It's just ridiculous. Nobody would take moral advice from these countries if their life depended on it. I mean, there's a good recent example where one of the periodic reviews of that's linked to the UNHRC, I mean, they had the representative from Saudi Arabia critiquing Norway on their treatment, the rights-related treatment of women. I mean, it's just you'd laugh out loud if someone articulated this in terms other than international law. And so the rights-related treaties are a problem.
We should perhaps clarify that HRC is Human Rights Commission?
Council. So basically,
rights.
Yeah,
also
up until 2006.
High Commissioner for Refugees, I mean, there are other agencies.
You've got the Convention on the Rights of the Child. You had this commission. It used to be called the Commission on Human Rights, the UN Commission on Human Rights. It got disbanded around 2005 or 2006 because it was seen as anti-Israel, anti-U.S., ineffective, and highly politicized. And they brought in this new body called the UN Human Rights Council. So they took the C and put it to the end. And, you know, 8-9 years later, what you see is that it's ineffective, it's highly politicized, it's anti-U.S., it's anti-Israel. Here's one that readers just won't believe. They make these resolutions condemning the rights record of countries around the world. there have been more resolutions condemning Israel than every other country in the world put together. At which point you can only, you know, who pays any attention to these people? Israel, we could start naming countries and we'd be talking for a long time out of the 192 of them, whatever, before we hit Israel. So to see, they're just obsessed, you know, they're highly politicized and they're obsessed. And so you get this situation where if someone says to you, the quality of international law, how does it compare to the law in North Korea? Well, it's good. How does it compare to the law in Sudan? Well, it's good. How does international law compare to the law in the U.S.? It's really bad. Canada, really bad. And so this is the problem. It's not that international law isn't better than the law of some authoritarian regimes, because it is. Of course, those are the countries that basically pay no attention at all to international law. When some periodic review condemns how Saudi Arabia treats its citizens, nobody pays any attention, as far as I can tell. But if they come to Canada and, you know, comment on how rent controls work or some highly debatable cause, it's not clear to me why anyone should care. If the democratic body makes a call one way and some UN body that claims to be experts on rights says you should have gone the other way, the response is really to laugh.
You had mentioned that America was about as good as it gets in terms of international law and keeping a distinction between
not paying too much attention to it. Yeah.
And yet, in your book, you do mention the immigration statute in Arizona.
Well, I mean, good as it gets is not the same as perfect. It's much worse in Canada. But you're right, it's happening, and especially with President Obama's administration. He seems to have a desire to be part of this system, which I would not have anything to do with. But at any rate, you're right. I do point out that it's problematic even in the U.S. But compared to what's happening in Canada or even Australia, you're still much better. So it's a comparative exercise. The book. I admit that the starting points of the five countries are all different. You've got the U.S. at one end, which is a real Madisonian checks and balances system, which I don't mind. I quite like federal. I mean, I'm a big federalist. I like elected bodies at the regional level or the state level checking elected bodies at the center. And I like an elected upper house checking an elected lower house. I have real problems with the sort of checking that's done these days by judges operating a Bill of Rights, because the way they interpret is so unconstrained. It leaves so much decision-making at the point of application. It doesn't even look like they're actually interpreting a document anymore to me. And from what you read with Justice Scalia, I infer that he's sort of much of my mind. If you get too far away from any notion of originalism in interpreting, you're better off with the elected legislature making the calls, which is something that I suppose would not be the most popular view in the U.S., but I certainly don't like that sort of check and balancing, because it's such a lawyer-driven, elitist in the bad sense of the word, undertaking, and they don't even actually make the right calls over time. I think the elected legislatures make better calls on these rights-related issues over time, which, of course, people can disagree with that on a factual level.
Now, you spend some time in your book talking about worldviews. You particularly mention the predicament that Mark Stein and McLean's magazine got into in Canada a couple of years ago. Could you share a little bit of that? Because that may be one of the telling examples in your book.
So Mark Stein, anyone listening to this or anyone hearing it later will know, is a phenomenally funny and talented political commentator. I don't just use him because he's originally Canadian, but he now lives and works in the U.S., but he spent a lot of time in the U.K., and he knows all the jurisdictions, actually, that we're talking about. And presently, right now in the U.S., he's being sued, but we'll leave that for a piece he wrote about global warming. But in my book, I talk about his troubles in Canada. So Canada has hate speech laws. Now, luckily, with your First Amendment, they're basically impossible. And there's two sorts of hate speech laws. One is sort of the criminal version, which are very hard to invoke. You need the permission of the Attorney General. Basically, there's been one case that's ever gone anywhere in Canada in 30 years. So basically, criminal hate speech laws where you can go to jail, they just don't get invoked. But there's this whole administrative, non-criminal, sort of pseudo-civil regime. It's since been disbanded as of about a year ago. And basically what happened is someone could make a complaint. Somebody didn't like what you say about some group. They feel like they're victims. And you'd go to this administrative body, and they'd sort of force the person to apologize and maybe pay you money. And this happened to Mark Stein. He wrote a book called America Alone, which many of your listeners will have read. It was a New York Times bestseller. It was a bestseller in Canada at the time. And a complainant who was linked to an Islamic group in Canada made a complaint. And at two provinces, I can't remember which they were, British Columbia and another one, maybe Ontario, and a federal similar commission, Stein and the magazine, which was called Maclean's, which is a broadly left-of-center magazine, by the way, they had excerpted one of the chapters from that book. Effectively, Stein was complaining about the extrapolating on birth rates for Muslims and saying the trends are terrible. Now, nobody complained about his facts. They didn't say he got the facts wrong. They just said they were offended, insulted. It was hate speech. He and Maclean's get brought before these Mickey Mouse little commissions where, by the way, complainants get all their legal costs paid, and the people brought before them get none of their legal costs paid. And some of them no defendant had ever won. Stein and Maclean fought the thing right through. They ended up winning in all three commissions, but they ended up spending something like $2 million. Now, if that's not chilling your free speech, I don't know what else is. And so in the light of that, he came and did a tour of Australia, and I was lucky enough to introduce him in Brisbane. And so out of the blue, I wrote him a while back and said, listen, here's my manuscript. Would you have a read and maybe give me a blurb for the book? And I had no expectation that he would. And out of the blue, I get this lovely blurb for the book. It was very kind of him. So here's the thing. It's as a person who's never really written for a lay audience before, I write a lot for newspapers. I'm sort of a right-of-center law professor. There's only about three of us in all of Australia. We can't travel on the same plane. So I thought, wow, this is the greatest thing ever. You get Mark Stein as a blurb. Well, my publisher in Canada is a university press, and I guess I should be grateful they even published the thing because there wouldn't have been anybody in the press who liked it. But at the end of the day,
we would not be having this conversation anyway.
No, we would not be. They didn't want to use Mark Stein's blurb on the cover of the book. We had this huge fight. Now, Mark Stein doesn't even know about this yet. So ultimately, they agreed to send out a little flyer with every book, but they didn't want to put him on the cover. This is the world they live in. They thought putting Mark Stein on the cover would hurt the sales of the book. So we had to drag it out fight. But anyway, they ended up just saying no. Now, luckily for me, in Australia, a publisher bought the rights, sort of a right-of-center publisher, maybe like Regnery or one of your publishers in the U.S., and Stein's all over the cover in the Australian edition, thank God, and New Zealand. But so I'm grateful to the McGill Queen's University Press for actually putting it out. But they live in a different world than I do. When you live in a world where you think Mark Stein's blurb is not a good thing to put on the cover of a book, you're just not living in the world I live in. And so I sent Mr. Stein a copy of the Australian edition with him right on the front cover all over the place. I've also got blurbs from John Howard, who was one of the great prime ministers of Australia. And I should say that Australia has a very close relationship with the U.S. We're the only country that has been at the side of the U.S. in every military conflict in the last 110 years. Hasn't missed one in Australia. Now, some people in Australia hate that fact, but I think it's quite a good one myself.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the United States and kind of bring this back a little bit from the wars and vendettas of media and publishing to talk a little bit about democracy. And I would play the devil's advocate as someone kind of steeped in the American experience and say, well, Professor, I mean, it's all very well to talk about New Zealand, but the peculiar history of the United States certainly involves as one of the most significant facts the exclusion from the start of the Republic on the right of voting and political participation of African Americans who were enslaved almost universally when the Constitution was adopted, and who, even after the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, after a brief period of Reconstruction, once again were the subjects of political coercion and discrimination, and very clear statutes designed to maintain a kind of American apartheid. I'm not having been in South Africa, I'm not familiar with the South African brand, but one could probably fairly say an American apartheid. And how does then your notion of just letting the numbers count democracy square with imperfect societies, which start off in a moral sense doing things that are very wrong and excluding people from the democratic process, a true tyranny of the majority? Sooner or later, doesn't some administrative or judicial body, or perhaps in the case of the United States in the Civil War, the army, have to break that stalemate and expand the definition of democracy?
Well, I mean, I agree with you totally, Jim. My book starts from about 40 years ago, but you can certainly see democracy not declining, but expanding all through the period you're talking about. Indeed, right up to the 60s in the U.S. with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, which really did all the hard work. I think it did more of the hard work than Brown v. Board of Education. It's those statutes of Congress which broke what you might see as the sort of Federalist deadlock, where, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that by the time you get to the late 50s, the majority of white people in the U.S. were not in favor of segregation. It was a problem with federalism in the sense that some of the states in the South, the majority of whites there were in favor. And so you did have a problem. And so as the Voting Rights Act comes in, the Civil Rights Act, you're expanding the input of people into decision-making. And clearly democracy is not in decline as you move into the 60s. My claim is that once you hit the 70s, things start to go into decline. So all of your points about African Americans in the U.S., I think it's right. I don't think there's, I mean, I'd even go further. If you're talking about a country other than the kind of five that I'm talking about, if you're talking about, say, I lived and worked in Hong Kong for 4 years, if someone says to me, Jim, do you prefer the sort of unelected top judges in Hong Kong making calls or the Chinese Politburo? I know I'm going with the judges. So it is, you know, the context matters. But once you get to the 70s or the 80s in the U.S., and you know there aren't those sort of obvious roadblocks to African Americans voting, and indeed of all the countries that I'm talking about, you've got an African American president, which is incredible. The U.K. hasn't done that, and Canada hasn't done that, and so that's quite an achievement. So my book says I'm talking about a bad trends that have gone for the last 3-4 decades. All of a sudden, the kind of left-of-center political parties that for 70, 80 years were pushing for more people to vote, all of a sudden, sometime in the last few decades, they flipped. You know, it's the left-of-center political parties now who don't seem to have enough confidence in their fellow voters to want the voters to be making calls on abortion or same-sex marriage or soon to come to the, you know, screens near you, euthanasia, or whether prisoners can vote. You just go through all the rights-related issues. They just go on capital punishment. And it's odd now, the kind of people who used to, you know, the kind of political left-to-center parties who were, you have to admit, were the ones who were to a large degree pushing extending the vote and getting more people. Now they don't seem to have very much confidence in that. They've done their work on that front. Now they're trying to restrict it. They want input from some Mickey Mouse UN oversight committee, or they want more input from a single judge in California. So I agree with you that what I'm talking about is a pretty recent phenomenon, 3 or 4 decades, in all of the countries I'm talking about. That's why I called the book at the beginning. It's either a lament, if you're pessimistic about breaking this trend, or it's a call to arms, because we need to change this trend.
With an American sort of readership, culturally we like our books to outline the problem and then kind of close with a 5-point program and an optimistic statement that that progress is around the corner or something. It's just kind of, in my opinion, maybe what we're used to in our political writing. Now you don't end your book with a 5-point program or really with seeing much light at the end of the tunnel, do you?
I'm a bit agnostic, I have to admit, because the kind of crowd I deal with professionally don't even think there's a problem. They're perfectly happy to have judges appeal to international law all over the place, even though, as I said, there's almost no democratic bones in the international law body. And they're perfectly happy to have judges make all sorts of calls, even ones that have no plausible connection to an honest interpretation of the legal text. They're basically just making it up. That doesn't seem to bother them too much, provided the judges make the call that they would have made if they could have, you know, legislated from first principles. So it's hard to be overly optimistic. On the other hand, we have a few originalist judges in Australia, not many, at the high level. And I live in the Antipodes for the last 10 years, Australia. I have lived in New Zealand. Politicians are very vigorous down in this part of the world in standing up to the judges. I mean, I think in the Northern Hemisphere, the U.S. is as good as it gets. It's much better than Canada, and the U.K. is a mess right now in terms of democratic input. But there's a very vigorous political culture down here in Australia. I mean, American readers won't believe this, but there have been 2 constitutional referenda in Australia where you change the constitution in Australia by having a referendum of the whole country. And also, you have to win in the majority of the states. But you basically count heads to try to get even a limited Bill of Rights, and the voters just keep saying no. And they even tried to have a statutory Bill of Rights. And part of the reason they keep saying no in Australia is they look and see what the judges are doing in the U.S. and Canada. And so proponents of a Bill of Rights, they can't just say, okay, look, we're taking a few things off the democratic table, but everything else will still be open to the legislature. It's pretty obvious when you look at what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere that that's not true. And so what you're really saying, if you push a Bill of Rights, if you're being honest, is you have no clue what the judges will do with this document. They could take it anywhere. And if you tell people that, I think if you'd told Madison that, he would have stuck with his first view. You know, Madison, as all your listeners will know, he was not for a Bill of Rights originally. He was the first Madison Constitution, which is a work of genius, was without a Bill of Rights. And that's sort of the version we have in Australia. And I think had he known, this is some sort of counterfactual little mind game, but had he known what judges would do with your Bill of Rights in the last 40 years, he would not have pushed it. I'm not overly optimistic, but I'm not complete pessimist either. There's at least a little more awareness that there's something wrong when 2 or 3 of your American Supreme Court judges start citing unratified treaties. And I think there's a little bit more pushback when you see the American Supreme Court making calls on same-sex marriage, or people actually go and read Roe v. Wade and discover that in terms of it being an honest interpretation of the American Constitution, it's a laughable joke. I'm agnostic. I wrote the book because I want something. I want to change the trend. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. I'd like to think that at some point people will become fed up with the sort of Thailand-style elites telling everyone that they have better moral sensibilities than the rest of us. These aren't really even law questions that I'm complaining about. It's not like they're interpreting a tax act or something. These are basically political and moral calls that lawyers have no more expertise on than anybody else, probably less to some extent. So I'm not totally pessimistic. It's hard to summon up too much optimism when you look around, but hopefully things will start to turn. That's why I wrote the book.
Well, that's you're at least, it seems to me, kind of honest about the question to the extent that you don't come up with 3 or 4 one size fits all answers to the trends that you see. and that's probably commendable. Is there anything? I mean, you had talked about the core of the book and what was and what was not a part of it. Is there anything that you and I have not covered that you think is a part of that core of the book?
No, I mean, I again, not to to make American listeners feel a bit better. If you compare what's happening in the U.S. to what's happening in Canada and Britain, the U.S. looks pretty good. I mean, Americans tend to think their judges are fairly powerful in terms of having the last word on a lot of issues. Well, the Canadian judges at the top level, I think, are more activist and they have more input. And indeed, recently, they told the Prime Minister that he wasn't allowed to appoint someone from Quebec to the Supreme Court that he had appointed. Don't think that would happen, and they basically turned a statute into part of the Constitution. Don't think that would happen in the U.S. It's the sort of thing you see in, amongst top judges in India, say, or you know, maybe Israel, where the judges tend to be pretty potent. In the U.K., you've got the whole added layer of problems with the European Union, which, in my view, is a sovereignty gobbling democracy diminishing machine, and it must be depressing because I'm an Anglophile, and indeed I say at the beginning of the book that my understanding of democracy is a sort of Churchillian one. Winston Churchill is quite well known for saying that democracy is the worst form of government except for everything else. I paraphrase slightly, and he's right. I mean, people who stand up and say there's nothing wrong with democracy, it always leads to good outcomes, are just clearly wrong. The question is, would you prefer decision-making or governance to be done by, say, really smart people from Harvard University? And William F. Buckley said he'd rather have the first 200 names in the Boston phone book. He's right. If you've ever worked in a university, the last people you'd want making decisions for society are people working in universities, not just because 95% of them are left of center, but because they're just not very good at it. Would you want a bunch of unelected ex-lawyers making calls? No, you wouldn't. So although democracy makes bad calls, and you have to understand the concept in terms of allowing bad calls to be made, it still does better than anything else, in my view. And that's why people move from non-democracies to democracies, and that's why democracies are by far the wealthiest places on Earth, barring the odd little oil sheikdom or something. And so I make that point. And I do say in the book that part of the reason that this claim of mine that democracy is in decline isn't quite as well publicized as it might be is I think there's various ploys that the elitist, internationalist, pro-judiciary crowd use. And I run through what those ploys are. And again, one of them is using democracy in an incredibly morally substantive way, so that it becomes very difficult to argue about how decisions are made. It all becomes whether they're decisions you think are morally good ones. There's other ploys that I go through, but basically that's the gist of the book. I talk about a few things in the future that I speculate on and whether they're going to make things worse or better. And that's basically about it.
I
was trying to write it for my mom so that she could actually read the book.
Very good. Why don't we ask Dean if he has any callers who would like to step up and stand, take a stand, or defend these Mickey Mouse agencies and some of the groups that Professor Allen has talked about who were making democracy sort of a less effective, less honest method of governing a society, or something like that.
Okay, well, in a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Professor James Allen, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor James Allen, he's the author of Democracy in Decline, available at Amazon.com and available at the link we sent around in the notice of today's call. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just about 10 minutes left. It looks like we've got three questions, Jim. So I'll go to the first question and ask the callers four questions now. So we'll try to get this done. Let's see if we can get these questions as succinct as possible. Let's go to the first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I have a little quibble with your use of the word democracy in this context without defining it. And what you seem to be trying to do is to examine the problem of human adequacy and also neglecting to adequately examine the problem of rational ignorance. Our Republican form of government was designed for an agrarian society where the issues were relatively simple. The issues today are highly technological, highly sophisticated, involving attempts to manage systems that no one really understands. And while one might get better decisions from a population that was more diligent at deliberation, the fact is that the experts don't manage very well either. So the best you might hope for to at least avoid the problem of public choice, the public choice problem, would be to go to a system of sortition where you have randomly selected citizens sitting as juries who have a chance to think about it over a period of time and to go into the matter deeply. Obviously, the average voter is not going to do that, nor would it be rational for him to do so.
Well, thanks very much for that question, John. I appreciate that. Well, let me just say three things briefly in response. Firstly, if you want the perfect example of moderately unaccountable elites making decisions, you only have to look at the European Union, where they make all sorts of decisions, including a new currency, based on input from basically undemocratic elites. And their track record, in my view, is terrible. It's not a good track record. Now, you're right, public choice theory has some things to tell us about decision-making and rent-seeking behavior. You hardly ever, though, see that same sort of cynical approach to understanding decision-making applied to the judiciary. I mean, you get lots of public choice theory applied to the legislature and how, you know, interest groups take over, blah, blah. But you almost never see that same sort of approach taken to the judiciary. And I think if you applied public choice theory to the judges, you'd say, wow, they're just as open to all sorts of non-perfect motivations. And then lastly, you're right. I do spend a bit of time on what the word democracy means, because once it stops being understood as a procedural tool, so I want people, we could throw away the word democracy and just say, decision-making by counting us all equally and letting the numbers count is not the perfect way of making decisions, but it has a pretty good track record on all sorts of fronts. And if I were being facetious, I'd say when people talk of tyranny of the majority, majorities don't do tyranny very well, John. Minorities do tyranny really well. When you look at the really horrible regimes, they're not majoritarian regimes. They're ones where a small group of people are doing terrible things. So I agree with almost everything you asked in your question. I'm very skeptical, though, that this idea of a small group of really well-educated, people with lots of technical expertise will end up making good calls. You just have to look again at the EU, and that's basically describes the European Union. Track record that's terrible, or at least it's not one that I'd want. I would not want to live in the European Union. And I think there's such a democratic deficit in the EU that people in Greece and Portugal and Spain are having economic policies that probably are wrong. They ought to get out of the euro, rammed down their throats with very little input. So part of your diagnosis I agree with, but I'm not sure that you really would want to go with what you seem to be saying. I think for all its faults, letting people have a say in big-ticket decision-making in the long term is the way to go. And I think experience shows that, but we can disagree about that.
Jim Haynes, should we continue to roll through the questions here? We've still got four questions pending.
I think that would be great. Thank you, Dean.
Right. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, Professor. My name is Jefferson Knight. I'm president of the Miami South Florida chapter. I sent you an invitation. I want to try to make this quick. You made the comment that you're against hate speech laws, and you noted the trouble that Mark Stein got into up in Canada, where my wife is from. But I wanted to ask you about the context of the Bill of Rights with regard to Australian firearms and what's happened with firearms laws down there. From our perspective, the Second Amendment has served us pretty well, and you point out the First Amendment makes hate speech laws impossible here.
You've picked up on a good thing. I mean, it's obvious, I think, that when I say that I don't like judges making all these calls, that sometimes judges are going to make calls that I really like. Now, that's you can't get into the game of saying I like X whenever X comes up with decisions I like. At least I don't think you can. It becomes unprincipled, and you really can't criticize. You can't. Then you have no basis for criticism. But your First Amendment, were I to be in a position to have to pick, I would pick your First Amendment jurisprudence. It's great. What I can say in response to that is that in Canada, the terrible hate speech law regime, so I don't like hate speech laws, but I would prefer them to be taken away by the elected legislature, and in Canada they have been. So recently this regime that was used against Mark Stein was repealed by Mr. Harper's Conservative government. The similar sort of thing is happening in Australia right now, where the new Tony Abbott government is trying to repeal their similar sort of administrative law hate speech regime. And in my view, that's a better way to do it in the long term, which is not to say that I don't like your First Amendment jurisprudence. I do like it. And I think you have, that's something you can point to where the outcomes have been very good. But it also is the same judges who then start delivering you all sorts of things you don't like, or, and there's very little you can do about it. On gun control... Sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to mention gun control or the Second Amendment, but go ahead. You were going into it.
Right. Every modern Bill of Rights, and most of them post-date the Second World War, A, they don't mention property, and B, they certainly don't have any right to bear arms. And, gun control is something that's much more prevalent outside the U.S. In fact, there's very few countries. Switzerland actually has more guns per capita than the U.S. It has a much lower gun violence. People point to Switzerland because it's a bit of an anomaly. There's more guns per person in Switzerland than there is in the U.S., and there's vastly fewer gun deaths. I think that's partly because they have a requirement that all males serve in the military, and they all come home with guns, and they're all trained and whatever, and they're all rifles and not handguns, and there's very few semi-automatic weapons. But Switzerland sits out as an example that the number of guns doesn't correlate with gun violence the way it does in the U.S. So there's almost no sympathy outside the U.S. for no limits on guns. And so if you put it to the legislature in any of these places, it would be dead on the water. And it would get no sympathy amongst the judges. So I don't know that you could create an American-type situation outside the U.S. because you would have no sympathy amongst the elites, and you'd have no sympathy amongst the voters, and there'd be no one to push it. So in that sense, the U.S. is idiosyncratic, or it's an anomaly. It just sits out there. It has no people pushing it. I just don't think you could ever recreate it outside the U.S. I don't know if that's depressing for your wife in Canada, where they've even had long gun registries that are now gone, as your caller would know, from his wife would have told him from Canada. So I don't think that's an issue that plays anywhere outside the U.S. because it has so little support amongst any group in society. There are other countries where it has support, by the way. As I said, Switzerland, some of the countries where you have citizen armies.
All right. Should we take another question, Jim?
Move on. Yes, indeed.
All right, two questions pending, so let's go to the next caller, see if we can get these final questions in.
This is Jack Park. Thanks very much for the effort that both of you put in. My question is this. From time to time, the United States, which has a disproportionate contribution, has withheld funds or participation from various UN entities with varying degrees of success. Have any of the other countries you've looked at or you consider, Canada, the UK, Australia, or New Zealand, done the same?
Well, thank you, Jack. Yes, you're right, of course, that under President Bush, the second Bush Jr., the U.S. cut off its funds to the UNHRC, and President Obama reinstated that. In fact, I don't think there's anything right now that the Obama administration has cut off, and President Reagan withheld funding to the UN, and in the hope to try to change some of the modes of operating. It's hard to reform the UN because you count countries. So the U.S. sits there with 330 million people, counts as one. You are on the Security Council, so you get a veto. And you can add up dozens and dozens of countries and not get to 330 million people. On the other hand, you don't just want to count population, or China would count for, you know, four times the U.S. or 3.5 times the U.S. But it is a body that at best was suited for action after the Second World War, not so much anymore. You need something. I mean, I'm not against the United Nations in the sense that you want somebody where you can discuss things in an age of nuclear weapons. What you probably don't want is the rights-related side of it, and what you don't want is an inability to do anything in terms of intervening in other states without going through the Security Council, because China and Russia have a veto. I don't know how you fix that, because to fix it, you have to get rid of the veto. Other countries are much less apt to withhold funding from the UN because they pay so much less. So the U.S. pays a lot, and it has, you know, it gets continually hammered by the UN, even though it's funding a large, substantial portion of the budget. Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper is good on foreign affairs, and he has withheld going to meetings and things. Especially, he's condemned. In fact, he's done a better job than the Obama administration in condemning the sort of obsession with Israel. So I think Harper's better on that front than Mr. Kerry and Mr. Obama. But there's not a lot of pressure on other countries to withhold funding because they don't pay such a massively disproportionate amount of the UN budget.
All right, let me ask very quickly, this is Dean Reuter again, if we have time for Professor James Allen and Jim Haynes. Can we take one final question?
Yes, indeed.
It's okay by me.
All right. Here we go.
Well, I don't know if you saved the best for last, but I appreciate you taking my question. Thanks for a great discussion. You know, the gun control and the gun law discussion, I thought, really gets to the heart of what decision people on the right have to make, because in D.C. versus Heller and McDonald versus Chicago, you know, we won. We overturned legislative law without any sort of popular support or popular uprising in those locales. And I just sort of wonder if, like with all political things, these are the new ground rules. There was a time where presidents in America didn't campaign. And if you had stood on that ground and said, well, we're not going to campaign because we haven't campaigned before and it's against our customs and our traditions, you would have gotten rolled. And if you'd said, well, we're not going to take money from corporations or businesses, the same would have happened. And I'm just really, although it's nauseating, whether the right is really going to have to just resolve itself that these battles are going to have to fought in the courts until the whole population sickens of it and begins to demand judges that simply, you know, call balls and strikes as the Chief Justice promised he was going to do. But I just don't see any other option than having to fight it out in the courts, because otherwise we're just going to get rolled. And I think gay marriage is a perfect example of them getting strike after strike after strike and getting to stay up at bat. So I'm just wondering, you know, as a kind of provocative question, whether we just have to forget the idea that the legislative is where we should focus and start fighting this where they're winning, which is in the courts.
Well, I mean, you're right. As a matter of how things stand at present, unfortunately, in my point of view, and it sounds like possibly yours as well, it is the final game in town. And so if you worry about affirmative action, you have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and let them argue, as they just did in that Michigan case. And maybe you don't really like the fact that Justice Sotomayor then reads out her decision from the bench. But here's the thing. There's nothing... As I said at the beginning, the Scalia understanding, or the originalist understanding of a Bill of Rights, where you start with a sort of New Zealand type setup, where in New Zealand everything is decided by the legislature. The limits are only political and moral. They can decide anything. And if you say, okay, we're going to take some things off the table, so we're going to take off the table cruel and unusual punishment, fine, not a bad idea. And then the question is, well, how do you interpret that? And if you interpret it in the way it was intended by the people who ratified it, you know, it doesn't grow forever. It stays at some sort of finite, locked-in level. Then you can debate capital punishment in the legislature. You know, that's fine. That's not an unattractive view of the world. Once you say to people, well, look, it doesn't matter what we write down. It doesn't matter how much people argue over every comma and word and phrase. Everything's up for grabs because the words are going to stay the same and the meaning's going to change. That's a very unattractive way of understanding it, and it potentially takes everything off the table for the legislature, which is awful. And the question then is, well, what do you do about it? And your caller's right. It looks like a lot of the action in the U.S. is in the courts. And from my perspective outside the U.S. looking in, and I've spent a fair bit of time in the U.S., but I'm outside looking in, some of that's not all that attractive. Will there be wins for people on your side of politics in the courts? Well, there will be. You might decide that on balance you're going to get more losses than wins, but there will be some wins. And then it becomes, well, we really have to spend a lot of time worrying about who gets appointed to the courts, which you do, and maybe we need a Republican Party with a bit of something known as a backbone on some of these issues, and you don't have that. All that's true. I would personally like to go back to the way judges did their interpreting even, you know, 60 years ago, where they were much less inclined to do this sort of thing, and they're much more inclined to leave things on the Democratic table. Whether you can ever go back, though, your caller's right. I don't know. That's why at the end of my book I'm not oozing optimism. But I think at some point maybe he's right, that people will just get sick of all these calls being made by people who have no more insight into the issues than a teacher does, or a plumber, or, you know, even a derivatives trader. So, I mean, I agree with your question. I don't know that there's an optimistic answer to it.
I would like to close on a note that is a little more upbeat than some of our conversation about the fate of democracy, and that is that this teleforum is actually quite historic. It is unique in that I think it is the first time the Federalist Society has ever interviewed a member of a national curling team. Professor Allen is also a member of the Australian curling team and went to, where did you go?
Well, I've been to a bunch of them. I mean, the fact is there's two, I'm Canadian originally. I was a second-rate Canadian curler, but there's 2 million curlers in Canada. And when it became an Olympic sport, it was the best thing ever for Canada because they could win some medals. And the rest of the world has about 200,000 curlers. The second biggest curling country in the world, by the way, is the United States of America in terms of participation, but it's all taking place in Montana, Dakota, a little bit of Minnesota, some in Seattle. At any rate, it would be impossible to make a national curling team in Canada. It's on TV every night during the winter, which tells you a bit about Canada. We moved to New Zealand. I played for New Zealand, and we went to some world championships. And now that I've just hit the age of 50, I've been to a couple of seniors, and I've just come back from Scotland. And
let me say that
the American team was a wonderful group of guys from Chicago.
So although we may sort of ponder and consider the possibilities for democracy in the future and great issues, the age of miracles in terms of interviewing someone who has played on the national curling team for more than one country. That is something that we have achieved. And if we have,
well, you have a great organization, by the way, Jim. We envy you here in Australia, or some of us do. It's a great organization, and some of your speakers occasionally make their way down to Australia. John McGuinness has come down.
Well, great. Dean, I think we're about done. I just wanted to point out the qualifications that don't always make it onto the book jacket.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and let me close by giving my thanks to our good friend, Mr. Jim Haynes, for his showing up and heading our call today. We certainly appreciate that. Our thanks as well to Professor James Allen, author of Democracy in Decline, the book we've been discussing today. To our audience, thank you also for dialing in and for your questions. A quick note that our next scheduled Teleform conference call next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern time after the holiday, we'll be discussing the Missouri versus McNeely U.S. Supreme Court case that answers the question about the exigency exception to the warrant requirement when extracting blood from an automobile driver. So that is next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.